This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscoane. You're going to need a roadmap to track the debate over access to emergency contraception and the most well-known brand, Plan B One Step. Back in 2011, Kathleen Sebelius, the head of Health and Human Services, overruled the FDA, which had concluded that the morning after pill was safe for, quote, all females of childbearing potential. Sebelius said that it would only be available to women 17 and older. Then in April, federal judge Edward Corman ordered the FDA to make the drug available to all females, regardless of their age, over the counter without a prescription. The FDA then set the age restriction at 15, requiring an ID when making the purchase and ensuring the drug was easily available to store shelves, or on store shelves, I should say. And now the Justice Department is going to appeal the federal court ruling. We have two guests who have joined us today on Radio Times. Jessica Ahrens is director of the Women's Health and Rights Program at the Center for American Progress and the Center for American Progress Action Fund, also a member of the Faith and Progressive Policy Institute. Jessica Ahrens, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us is Joan Vinaki, columnist for the Boston Globe's op-ed page. And Joan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
And it is an extremely complicated issue. Jessica, let me begin with you because I had to go over my introduction to the show several times just to make sure that I got the most recent history on emergency contraception correct. Why do you think this is such a political hot potato?
Well, yes, Marty, first of all, you did get it correct as far as I can tell. I think that it's a political hot potato because it's been reduced to a conversation about teens and sex, and that is just a conversation that Americans still are fundamentally uncomfortable with. I believe, however, that conversation is a distraction from what the real issue should be here, which is that emergency contraception is medication that has been found to be safe and effective by use for women and girls of all ages, and it's contraception that needs to be used in an emergency, as its name suggests. And so time is of the essence. The sooner it is used after unprotected intercourse, the more effective it will be in preventing a pregnancy. And so women need to be able to get it without restrictions and barriers. They need to get it on a moment's notice. So that's why, knowing that it's a safe and effective drug, it needs to be on store shelves so that women of all ages, meaning mostly adults who we're talking about using it, can get to the store and get the product and purchase it without any delays.
Well, Joan, let me go to you, and then I do want to flesh all of this out, but I'd just be curious about why you think this has become such a controversial issue difficult to resolve on top of it.
Well, because I think that it is a conversation about teens and sex. And the other arguments that were just raised are kind of a distraction from that. I've kind of staked out the unpopular middle ground, which I think is where the Obama administration is right now. And I guess I just don't think it's a terrible thing to say that it should, you know, that 15 and over, which would allow the adults that, you know, need it and would be, you know, that it's mostly targeted to, would be able to get it without any questions asked.
And when you say middle ground, and I read your piece in the Boston Globe, I mean, you describe yourself as pro-choice.
Yes, I am pro-choice, and I'm not, you know, I'm not naive. I happen to be the mother of a 19-year-old girl, so I've been through, I mean, I've certainly had some conversations about sex with her, but I don't pretend to know everything that she's doing now or everything that she did when she was in middle school, although I remain hopeful about certain things.
You and every other parent. But I mean, are you looking at this as a parent yourself, to sort of imagining your own child in a certain situation?
Yes, I guess I am thinking of it. I mean, I wrote the column and sort of talked about the politics of parenthood. And I don't know why I am pro-choice. Again, I'm not naive about sexuality and, you know, teenagers having sex and any of that stuff. But I don't know why we have to just to accept the idea that really young, call them, you know, boys and girls or young teenagers, are having sex and making decisions, you know, all on their own to walk into a pharmacy and buy something like this off the shelves. I guess, maybe it is naive, but I just don't know why we have to just accept that as a given and not be able to say that a parent has a right and an interest in knowing that a 12 or 13-year-old girl is doing that.
Well, Jessica, let me go back to you, because I think most people feel that when it comes to older teenagers and adults, that access to emergency contraception is relatively acceptable. I mean, there's some people that don't believe that, but I would say a large portion of the population does. It seems to be whether the cutoff is at 17, whether it's at 16, whether it's at 15, or whether there's any cutoff at all. It really is about teenagers and sexuality.
Well, again, I think that people want to make it a conversation about teenagers and sexuality, and I'm happy. I appreciate having the opportunity to address these concerns. Obviously, we all want teenagers to be safe. We want them to be making thoughtful decisions when they become mature and ready to do so. And those of us who are advocating for emergency contraception to be available on store shelves without an age limit are certainly not in any way advocating that teens should be making any of these decisions necessarily on their own. I think that, to the extent possible, whenever there is a reliable, trusted adult in their lives that they can turn to make such decisions, they absolutely should do so. But again, the people who are normally going to be going into the stores to buy emergency contraception are going to be older. Either they're going to be older adolescents or they're going to be people who are adults. Mm-hmm. And I should note that the Plan B One Step retails for an average of $50. So just as a practical matter, a younger adolescent probably won't have that kind of money in their pocket, won't be able to go in and purchase such medication unless they have someone who's older involved. The other point I'd like to make is that an age restriction actually doesn't prevent an older person from purchasing the medication for a younger adolescent. And so in that way, an age restriction doesn't actually have the intended effect of protecting younger adolescents. I think we have plenty of laws on the books in this country that do intend to and are effective most of the time in protecting younger children. And those should be absolutely enforced, and we need to do everything we can to protect children who might be vulnerable. But
do you think, though, that $50, is that a barrier in and of itself to access?
Definitely, and actually that's a troubling part of the FDA's recent decision. What they did was they approved an application from Teva, the maker of Plan B One Step, to have exclusive rights for over-the-counter the marketing of an over-the-counter emergency contraception product for the next 3 years. What that means is the generic version remains in this other hybrid category of what's called behind the pharmacy counter, where people 17 and older can go to the pharmacy, ask the pharmacist for next choice, the generic version, which is more affordable, and they won't need a prescription. But if you're under 17, you will need a prescription for that product. And so the only product that's going to be available on store shelves, still, you have to have an ID and you have to be 15 or older to prove your age. But that's going to be the Plan B One Step, and that's the version that is more expensive.
Joan, let me go back to you. And I think we could all agree, under ideal circumstances, if a teenager, let's say, has unprotected sex, that you would want them to go to an adult, to a parent, and get their help for that situation. But the question is, for those kids that don't have someone for a whole host of reasons, they don't have that reliable adult that they can turn to, what do we do for them if they don't want to get pregnant and they've had unprotected sex?
Well, I guess I would argue that maybe we should again be suggesting that having sex at that age is not such a great idea, and B, if they are going to have sex at that age under 15, that they shouldn't be having unprotected sex, because pregnancy is a possible outcome of that. And I mean those are lessons and things that can be said to kids of that age just as easily as telling them that, hey, if you make a mistake, you can never mind, within 24 hours you can go to the pharmacy and get Plan B off the shelves. I mean, it requires education to tell them that Plan B is out there, why not make those mm-hmm. other arguments as well? And again, I mean, I understand that not everybody has, a mother or an adult that they feel comfortable having that conversation mm-hmm. with, but I suppose schools, mm-hmm. doctors, other places could be at least having those kinds of conversations.
But I think the question is, if a girl, a teenager, makes a mistake, what does she do?
I don't have the answer to that. I mean, the answer that you both are arguing, I'm like the odd person out here, is, well, it should be there because people make mistakes. And I mean, you're right. I mean, people do make mistakes. I guess I just think that part of the conversation and part of society's message should be, if you're 12, 13, 14, it'd be better to avoid that mistake than having to go and then take the next step of trying to find $50 to get Plan B. Well, and again, I'm not a medical expert, and
sure.
I only know what I've, read about this, and I see that the argument is that it's safe and it's one of the safest things that you can take. But I have read some accounts by women who support Plan B who say that it's not just like popping a Tylenol, that, your body does have a reaction to it. And again, I mean, I just wonder what it would be like to be 12 or 13 or 14, take this, and it seems like it'd be pretty scary in some ways.
Well, and I think that's a really good
maybe
point.
Maybe less scary than,
being pregnant.
Realizing that you're pregnant and 9 months later you're having a child. But again, it's all about, an overall conversation, an overall message from society about, what's the best course that people should be taking.
Sure, and just so you know that I haven't chosen sides here, but let me...
Well, you sound a little bit on the
okay,
on the
well,
side,
let me put a question to Jessica, because you have to get a prescription for birth control. If you go to the school nurse to get an aspirin, you need your parents' permission. There are medical, or I should say medications, that do require a parent's permission.
Yes, there certainly are. However, this is one that shouldn't need a parent's permission. Joan said she's not a medical expert, but the medical experts have been in support of having Plan B or some other kind of emergency contraception available on store shelves without an age limit, including the American Academy of Pediatrics. Again, this is a safe and effective form of medicine. The FDA itself has found that to be the case multiple times. And there may be side effects. Some people are going to experience side effects when they take the medication, but it doesn't have any long-term serious negative health effects. Again, that shouldn't be a reason to restrict its access. And I just want to...
You know what? Hold on to that thought, only because they're playing my song. We have to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about emergency contraception, the morning after pill, and the debate over its availability. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Garden State Wine Growers Association supports WHYY and presents its annual Mother's Day Wine Trail Weekend, May 11th and 12th. In celebration of Mother's Day, the trail features wine tastings and special treats for mom from noon to 5 p.m. at participating wineries. From the Skylands in northern Sussex County to the tip of Cape May, there are 6 different trails showcasing wines from more than 40 wineries throughout New Jersey. The annual Mother's Day Wine Trail Weekend. Full details at NewJerseyWineTrails.com.
Let me take these few seconds to thank the many listeners who expressed support of our program services during HYY's recent campaign. You continue to come through at a time of further declines in traditional sources of revenue. The result? Well, it matters tremendously. I'm Bill Morazzo, WHYY's president, and thanks to you, we're growing our investments in program services, and they're designed to help you stay engaged in your community. You count on us, and we count on you. Thank you.
The last gift Elizabeth Benedict got from her mother may seem ordinary, but the feelings it unlocked were anything but.
I was literally confused by how I could feel this attachment to the scarf and having felt so much distance from my mother.
Hers is just one of the powerful essays in the new book, What My Mother Gave Me. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're tracing the complicated history of emergency contraception, exploring some of the politics of this very charged issue, asking if girls as young as 15 should have access to the morning after pill without seeing a health provider, without their parents' knowledge and permission. And again, talking with Joan Vinaki, columnist for the Boston Globe's op-ed page, had a piece on this, and Jessica Ahrens. She's director of the Women's Health and Rights Program at the Center for American Progress. We just had an explosion of phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. Jessica, do you remember what you wanted to say when I interrupted you?
I think I was just going to add that, you know, studies and other things have shown that making emergency contraception available does not encourage sex. It does not encourage promiscuity. And I don't disagree with Joan that part of the conversation should be more than just, here's this medication you can take if you make a mistake. I do think it should be available so that people do have a second chance to prevent unintended pregnancy. But I do agree we should be having a conversation about root causes of unintended pregnancy, of being ready, you know, not having sex too soon. I think those conversations are happening in large part in our culture anyway. I think that this is another good opportunity to have that conversation. I just think that our policies shouldn't be based on simply what our ideals are for our culture alone. And that's why it's important for the FDA and other agencies to be able to make policy decisions based on the evidence and the science before them. And I think we need those agency decisions to have integrity and to be protected from politics as much as possible.
Let me go back.
Can I just add something?
Yes, please go ahead.
I'm just sort of expressing a personal opinion and reaction to the whole thing. It's not like I'm getting ready to march in front of a pharmacy and say, don't sell Plan B or anything like that. I just think it's interesting, again, that it's kind of now we've gotten to the point where it's just a given and accepted that we're saying, teenagers this young are having sex and there should be access to this when there are so many other things that are regulated, and that this is now something that we're to the point that we're saying it should be unregulated. You have to be 18 to buy cigarettes, 21 to buy alcohol. You need a prescription not just for birth control pills, but, you know, for acne medicine. Parents have to sign permission slips for a child of that age to play sports, to go on a field trip, to get the HPV vaccine, all of that, yet now this is just carved out as something that the parent has no interest in knowing about or regulating in any
right.
way.
And Jessica, I mean, it seems to me that's a fair point, which is why has this been carved out, to use Joan's language?
Well, in some ways, it's been carved out as restricted, whereas when you look at other over-the-counter medications, there are plenty of medications on store shelves that might not be safe for children of young ages to take. That doesn't mean that there's an age restriction. There is still an expectation of parental supervision. There is still an expectation that people will be responsible in purchasing and using medication that is available on store shelves.
You mean something like cough medicine or something of the like that?
Absolutely. Exactly. Cough medicine, Advil, what have you. There are products that are more recommended for children of young ages. There's specifically children's medicine that we sell over the shelves, on the store shelves. And then there are products that are really geared toward adults, and there may be warnings on the packages that say it should not be used by children. But that doesn't mean that we require people to show identification in order to purchase the medication when it has been ruled to be safe and effective for the general population. And that's what is happening here with the FDA ruling. And this FDA ruling that would have happened but for Secretary Sebelius's intervention actually found that it was safe and effective for use not just by adults, not just by a general population, but also by adolescents at all ages. And so we have the data, we have the science and the evidence, and we know that if younger adolescents use this product, they won't be physically harmed. And I think, again, we have to come back to the point, it's really important to remember that even if they're not using this product, by requiring an for people to show their ID by imposing an age limit, you are restricting access to people who are older. Immigrants who don't have IDs, lots of people of color who, again, you know, we've seen in the debates about voter ID laws, the effects, the deleterious effects it can have on specific populations who tend not to have ID as often as other populations. And so you are creating barriers that are unnecessary to getting a time-sensitive medication.
Joan, I was doing some reading in preparation for the show today, and I saw someone who advised parents actually to go ahead, buy emergency contraception, keep it in your house, use this as a conversation or a conversation starter so you could talk to your daughter about its use or possible misuse, thereby having it there readily available, but also using it as a way to start a conversation about sexual activity. Would that make sense to you at all?
It might for other people. It's not something that I'd be doing when my daughter was 12 or 13. I actually did have a conversation with my daughter last night, telling her I was going to be on this radio show, and asking her what she thought as a college student just finishing up her sophomore year. And I, maybe she's her mother's daughter or whatever, but she just said that she thought 12 or 13 was too young to waltz into a pharmacy and buy that. And we did not, talk about what she did or didn't do when she was that age. So I don't know. She just thought that it would be a really difficult thing to do. And also, logistically, that kids that age wouldn't make a decision fast enough for it to be effective. If they had made a mistake, there might be some that, I suppose, with the proper education and, being told that it was there and that you had to, do it within a certain time limit. But she was just thinking back to middle school and how you would go back to your friends and talk it through. And, by the time you figured out what you had to do, it would be too late.
Let me just throw out something that I got from the Guttmacher Institute. 8.6% of girls/women have had sex by the age of 14. In the year 2008, 10,200 girls, 14-year-old girls, were pregnant. 3.4% of 13-year-olds have had sex, and the average age of first intercourse is age 17. Are those numbers significant, Jessica?
Well, I think it just shows that there are, despite our discomfort with the idea of young adolescents having sex, the fact is it does happen on some level. I think it's still a very small proportion, as those numbers indicate. Mm-hmm. I just don't think we should be making policies about the margins. I think we should be making our policies geared toward the vast majority of people who would benefit. And so there are some younger teens who clearly do need access to Plan B because they are having unprotected sex, and it would be better if they had another opportunity not to get pregnant. But I actually don't think having Plan B on store shelves is going to do much for the 8% or so of teens that you just referenced. I think it needs to be on store shelves without restrictions, with for the general population to be able to use it and access it as time-sensitive fashion as possible.
And Joan, I think what often gets buried in a conversation like this is there has been a pretty dramatic decline in teen pregnancy since 1988, 2008, looking at, I guess, some old numbers. And the idea is that the teen pregnancy rate has gone down, and it looks like there is more use of contraception. And I think that should be good news for all of us. You want to weigh in on that? Then we'll get to our callers.
Well, I would put that in the good news category, too.
As would I.
Indeed. Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Joan Vinaki, columnist for the Boston Globe's op-ed page, Jessica Ahrens, director of the Women's Health and Rights Program at the Center for American Progress, and again, as I said, an explosion of phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. We are talking about emergency contraception, the morning after pill, as it is called. Let me get Mary Tyler from Phoenixville to join us. And Mary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, lady. Thank you so much for taking my call
sure.
and for touching on this, very potentially volatile subject.
Sure.
But one thing that I've noticed that all three of you are talking about is that teenagers are completely irresponsible with their contraception. One thing that the Plan B is there for is for when contraception fails. And you're also talking, you made mention about the girls being the only participants in this. Well, they're obviously not the only participant. So I think educating our young men and our teenage boys on this is just as vital as educating our young women.
It's two very good points, Mary. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Jessica, perhaps I can toss the first one to you about contraceptive failure.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly, Mary, thank you for your comments. I certainly did not intend to suggest that I thought all teenagers were irresponsible and didn't use contraception. That's certainly not what I was saying. I think that there are a lot of responsible teenagers who, if they do have sex, they've thought about it and they've taken precautions. And I agree that a lot of the times what we're talking about also is contraceptive failure when a condom breaks, for instance. Or perhaps the pill that someone was using had expired or wasn't the right exact prescription for them after all, and they need to go back and try something else. But maybe there's a way they realized it wasn't working in time to use Plan B. So there are a lot of different situations that we're dealing with here. I also appreciate the point about boys being involved. Absolutely, two people, it takes two to tango, as they say. And I would say another reason why it's important to be able to have this product on store shelves without barriers is because some men who are responsible partners have tried to go and purchase Plan B or other kinds of EC for their female partners. And these are adults I'm talking about. And previously, before the recent FDA action saying 15 and over, Plan B used to be behind the pharmacy counter. And some men would try to purchase it, and the pharmacist would refuse to sell it to them because they were men, even though they met the age limit. So again, we've seen a number of barriers erected unnecessarily to people accessing the medication in a timely fashion.
What are your thoughts, Joan?
I pretty much agree with what was just said, and I think that the caller made a good point about contraception failing versus people not using it.
Jessica, this emergency contraception, though, would not prevent STDs, right?
That's right. And I think people really need to understand that this is not really the only effective contraception that also prevents STDs is condoms, which I note are available to all ages on store shelves. Without requiring ID.
Let me get
point taken.
Point taken. Fair enough, Joan. Let me get Sally from Landenburg to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Sally. Go ahead. You're on the air.
I love you so much. Listen every day.
Oh, thanks.
I'm so glad to be on because my passion is, what a topic. I'm so glad that this pill is currently available, and I believe it should be available to all young men and women, again, outside of behind the pharmacy counter. It should be out for all. At a very young age, I was sexually active. And, Joan, I did talk to my mom. I went to her at the age of 12 and said, I'm ready to have sex. And she said, oh, no, you're not. You know, we're Catholic. We should abstain. Went through the whole process and discussion. So, to marry the caller's point, my boyfriend and I chose to have sex anyway. We used condoms, and condoms do fail. So I found myself 12 pregnant.
Wow.
And then needing to go through an abortion at 4 months of pregnancy, which is a terrible two-step process. It was very painful. And I live with that for the past 30-some years now. So I believe if I had a daughter, obviously I'd talk to her about safe sex or abstention. But ultimately, it should be there because the alternative to taking that morning after pill is a lot more to live with for the rest of your life.
Well, Sally, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give Joan a chance to weigh in on her story, frankly. Joan, go ahead.
Well, I think when you hear a story like that, it helps me, it opens my mind to it.
Yeah.
Again, I mean, what I wrote and my feelings are just kind of a personal reaction, and maybe it is a squeamishness or a wanting the world to be a place that it really isn't anymore. Quite, you know, honestly, I mean, I the passions about this, I don't really understand it. I don't quite understand why people are ascribing some, you know, dire political motive to the Obama administration, because I don't see what they have to gain from it at this point. He's not running for re-election. He doesn't have to play to the political right, if that's what the argument is. You know, maybe he's and Kathleen Sebelius is having the same kind of parent emotional response that, you know, you all are saying shouldn't be part of it because this is about science and that shouldn't be part of the equation.
Well, Joan, let me just say to you and to our listeners and also to Jessica as well that we want you on this program, and we invited you to be a guest on this program, frankly, because of what you wrote as a parent. And we think and believe that, that the points you made are valid ones, and they actually do underscore what the president said about his daughters and just the uncomfortableness that, that parents have on this issue. I think it's a fair issue and certainly worth talking about. Jessica, just be, I don't want Joan to feel uncomfortable.
Oh, no, that, I don't, believe me, I don't feel uncomfortable.
Okay,
I write twice a week, and I usually at least 90% of the people who read it disagree with what I have to say. So I'm quite used to that.
Okay, well, we didn't disagree.
Don't worry about that.
Okay,
my feelings are not hurt. Oh. I am trying to think it through and listening to what people have to say.
Well, and congratulations for that, because there isn't enough listening of anything through these days. Jessica, let me go back to you, because I'm looking at a headline of an article in Slate, actually written by Emily Bazelon, mm-hmm. and the headline says, "The Politics of Prude." Mm-hmm. That bothered me, I have to say. The idea that if you opposed emergency contraception, that somehow you were a prude.
Well, I unfortunately haven't had a chance to read Emily's piece yet, so I can't
piece.
Into a full defense of her. But I you know, obviously this is controversial. It's an emotional issue, and I certainly don't think it should be one that is devoid of a debate about values. I understand Joan's perspective. I think it's a very common perspective, and I agree it is the president's perspective. I do think that his decision or his support of Sebelius's decision has been motivated mostly by emotion and a sense of values. More than anything else, probably, but at this point, at least. But I think there are a lot of countervailing values as well. I think there is respect for science and integrity in decision making, in public decision making, and policy making. I also think there's values of women's rights and equality. You know, as my comment about condoms suggested, mm-hmm. you know, I do think there is a bit of a double standard at play here. We're not having a debate. We might have had a debate a couple of decades ago about whether condoms should be available, whether they should be sold, whether they should be easily accessible for 12-year-old boys, for instance. We seem to have moved past that point in our society on that debate. We are now having that debate, though, about emergency contraception, I think because the conversation does focus on these 12-year-old girls who may be having sex. And I understand the discomfort with that. At the same time, I just don't think that's what should drive the policies. I think there is a role for that concern in our cultural conversation, but I don't think that's what should make the ultimate decision when it comes to public policy.
Well, let's take another short break. And Sally, thank you for that phone call to Radio Times. You can call us as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Talking with Jessica Ahrens and Joan Vinaki about the morning after pill emergency contraception. And it's been a pretty hot political potato in the last couple of years. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Thomas Jefferson University School of Population Health supports WHYY and offers a fully accredited master's degree in public health. An open house will be held on Wednesday, May 15th in the school's offices on the 10th floor of 901 Walnut Street. Registration by phone 215-503-0174 or online at jefferson.edu/openhouse. The Thomas Jefferson University School of Population Health, bringing health and healthcare together.
On the next Fresh Air, how Wall Street defanged Dodd-Frank. Gary Rivlin tells us how this Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, which was signed into law 3 years ago, has subsequently been attacked and weakened by financial industry lobbyists and lawyers. It's the subject of Rivlin's article in The Nation. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Remember the days when gas cost $1.50 a gallon? That's how cheap it is now to fill up with natural gas. Drivers are doing it, but pumps are few and far between. Also, movie stars accused of co-opting Kickstarter to fund projects. Is it time to call it Rich Starter? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about emergency contraception with Joan Vanacki, columnist for the Boston Globe's op-ed page, and with Jessica Ahrens, director of the Women's Health and Rights Program at the Center for American Progress. Let's see what Barbara from Norristown has to say. And Barbara, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. And as so many other people say, I appreciate you and what you've done to educate the public.
Thank you so much.
And I'm especially appreciative of the conversation today because I'm a nurse, psychotherapist, and professor of nursing, and I've raised five daughters and have five granddaughters. So I feel professional and a personal connection to the issue. I just want to make one comment that I don't think has been made, and that is, as a mom and as a grandmother and as a woman, we all want our children to come to us, and we create this atmosphere where they can feel safe, and they do come to us. But the point that I've found in my own life and in my practice is that the best moms, the most beloved moms, are the moms that sometimes the girls do not come to because they don't want their mom to think they're not their good daughter and that they're pregnant or they're having sex. And so sometimes it's the very best moms that don't get talked with. And that's just my point.
Well, I think it's interesting. Are you saying, Barbara, the idea that a daughter may not want to disappoint a parent or disappoint
exactly.
their mother?
Exactly. You know, they don't. They just can't talk to their mom about it because they do love their mom and they do have a good relationship with their mom. And so it's, you know, kind of taboo now to bring this up that their good little girl is pregnant or having sex.
Well, that's really...
There's an option for those young women that are in that position.
Well, that's a very interesting comment. And Joan, I'm going to toss that first to you.
Well, I like to think I'm a good mother, and probably the chances are that my daughter might not have, you know, come to me because she didn't want to disappoint me. So, I think it's all these things are valid points. Again, you know, my larger issue is just this... acceptance of just the idea that younger and younger people are having sex and that there's no way to stop that and that the only, you know, that the best we can do is say, you know, use birth control and if you don't or if it fails, go to Plan B. Hmm. And, I mean, maybe it is the best we can do and maybe that is the best policy that we can have. But, again, I mean, I don't think it's a bad thing to be forced to talk about it and think about it and just sort of be faced with the reality of what's going on out there and questioning whether that's what should be happening. I mean, again, and like the parental interest in knowing what's going on. Just to throw out one more example that, you need your parent, you have to be 16 or older to get a tattoo, but not this. So, again, I mean, it's something to think about. It's something to talk about. I don't think it's something to just... sort of, you know, blindly accept without at least thinking through what this all means.
Yeah, Jessica, I'd be curious about your thoughts.
Well, I don't think that it's actually the only thing we can do, that we have to resign ourselves to the fact that teens are having sex at younger and younger ages. I think that one strategy that has been shown to be effective at teens delaying first intercourse is comprehensive sex education programs. Unfortunately, that itself has also been a hot political potato over the years. And instead, government funding has often gone to abstinence-only programs that don't necessarily teach teenagers the life skills they need to make thoughtful decisions about whether and when to have sex, and don't teach teens how to protect themselves when they do decide to have sex. So I don't think that we just have to resign ourselves to the fate of, oh, this is just going to happen, and there's nothing we can do about it. I think, you know, families have conversations about sex all the time that teach children thoughtful decision-making, teach them how to wait until they're mature and ready, and you know, comprehensive sex education programs do so as well. I think abstinence-only programs often just try to instill fear and shame and then have teens engage in activity that is more impulsive. And so I do think there are solutions, and it's a network of solutions. It's not just one thing. I don't think that having emergency contraception on the shelves is a silver bullet. I see it as one piece of the puzzle.
But do you see it as a last resort? I mean, it is called emergency contraception.
That's right. It's a backup form of birth control. It is not meant to be the first line of defense. And again, it's only when people have had sex and contraception has failed, or they didn't use contraception for one reason or another.
Joan, did you want to?
I definitely agree with the sex education program, and I am not into abstinence only. I am not Nancy Reagan. I think there should be funding for, you know, sex education. I don't have any problem with that.
Let me. Thanks for the call, Barbara. Let's see what Paulette from Mullica Hills has to say. Paulette, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I totally agree with your very last caller, so I won't reiterate what she had said, but I am, just to give a different perspective, I'm 66 years old. I grew up in an ultra-religious home. I had caring parents, but because of religious and the taboos of the basically 50s and 60s, sex was never discussed. I learned about sex from older friends, basically. And, of course, times have changed, and I have two daughters. And when they were in their younger teens, I made sure that they were aware that, you know, there was a need for birth control if they found themselves at a point that they chose to have sex. Preaching against having sex or, you know, anything like abstinence is not really going to make a difference. I find, just like I would not listen to my parents, and I discount anything practically that they told me. My children were basically like that, too. I felt responsible enough that I brought them to a doctor to have him talk to them and give them birth control pill prescriptions.
That's interesting.
But
Paulette,
parents who are not that responsible, for whatever reason, right, they don't really care about their children, and it's those children that really suffer, that the parents don't get involved. And if it was an ideal world, all of these great ideas of waiting until you choose a permanent partner and you're ready to make a commitment and everything, it would all work fine. But there are so many children in today's world that are overrun by these raging hormones and don't have any guidance. And for whatever reason, they can find themselves in positions that things go too far, and things are starting younger than they were. I really think that this morning after pill is not an answer. I get very emotional when I start thinking about reproductive rights and the abuses that our society is trying to bring. It's all a very personal issue.
Well, you know what,
Paulette?
Yeah, let me take your point, and I think your story about both yourself and what you did with your daughters is illuminating in many ways. And the fact, Joan, that she felt that you know, children don't listen to their parents anyway, so she took them to her doctor to talk to her, and sounds like talk to them and to give them birth control.
Well, I mean, I did the same with my daughter. So, I mean, not to have the doctor talk to her, but she got a prescription for birth control pills when she was, you know, probably a senior in high school. I have a son. We talked about birth control with him. So it's not as if I'm, you know, coming from another era or another century, or I don't think that any of that is part of what people should be talking about. You know, again, I mean, my perspective is just, and I fully appreciate what's been said about sex education and the fact that, you know, probably the people, the young people that need this the most are the ones that might not have the family structure or the, you know, the backup where they can go to people or for guidance and all that. So I see the arguments. I hear them. I guess, you know, it's not a terrible thing if it's out there. Maybe it's even a good thing. I just have a personal resistance to the idea of availability at such a young age when there are restrictions on other things. But that's just me.
No, that's okay. But Jessica, I'm also thinking of the I mean, frankly, the loneliness I can imagine of a pregnant 15-year-old.
I mean, we do know that when teenagers face an unintended pregnancy, there is a feeling of desperation. I think that actually happens to women of all ages, and that's why advocates like myself have fought so hard to either create or maintain laws that allow access to a range of reproductive health care needs, including birth control and abortion care, because a woman facing an unintended pregnancy, it's when you don't want to be pregnant, when you want to be pregnant, it's a wonderful thing. When you don't want to be pregnant, it's a terrible thing. And we just need to have laws and policies, I think, that support women and girls in their ability to make decisions for what's best for them in their circumstances.
Let me get an anonymous caller from New Jersey to join us on Radio Times. And go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm calling with regard to the category of use for the Plan B in the circumstance of an unreported sexual assault. It's a situation that is emergent, it's time sensitive, and, you know, a vulnerable young woman needs access to that. In my circumstance, when my daughter was assaulted, she was not at home. She called me, she told me about it, and when I got my wits about me, as I was jumping in my car, I said, find your best friend, get to a pharmacy, and take a Plan B pill.
And did she?
And she did.
And is she okay?
It's been a long road, but yes. Yeah. And there's, you know, there's somebody with a good relationship with a parent in an urgent situation that was, under that circumstance, one less thing to worry about.
Well, I appreciate your call. It's an important call. And, of course, we're all sorry to hear what happened to your daughter. And it sounds like, you know, you were there for her. It's a good thing that she gave you a call. Let me give Jessica Ahrens a chance to weigh in on your comment. Thanks for the call. Jessica?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you and all the other callers who have shared their personal stories, because I think it's only through sharing these stories that it really allows people to understand the full complexity of the issue and all the different circumstances that can arise. And I am very sorry for what happened to your daughter. Mm. But I completely agree that this is why this drug needs to be available, you know, for people to get without restrictions, without barriers, without questions, because there are going to be circumstances where they need it in their hands as soon as possible. And certainly in the situation of a sexual assault, it's one less thing to have to worry about in a terrible situation.
Joan, anything you want to add to that?
Well, I agree, and I think the personal stories are very powerful.
Thank you for the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Colleen from Kimberton has to say. Colleen, go ahead. You're on the air. Hi, Colleen. Go ahead.
Hi there. Hi. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
A couple of things. One is that, you know, it's not exactly the same conversation as 10 or 15 years ago with condoms and 12-year-old boys, because we're talking about a pill that girls are taking while they're developing and still very vulnerable in a lot of physical ways. So we're not talking a lot about the side effects and potential consequences on there, and I would like to hear if there is any feedback on that. The other thing is, I'm actually a school counselor, and there is research out there that indicates that, first of all, family values being instilled as a family is actually really important. I agree that comprehensive sexual education has to happen, but I think some of that pressure does have to be replaced on the families, since I work with them and I see what happens on a day-to-day basis. Because there's nothing better, and there's research to support this, than families instilling their family values on their kids.
Well, Colleen, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Joan, I'm going to give you the last point that she made about the importance of family values.
Well, I think she raised some interesting points on kind of, you know, raising sort of the other side of the issue. When you say family values, I mean, I think... What do you mean by that?
Well, and I'm assuming family values about what it is that we believe in, you know, how we treat other people, how we treat each other, honesty, integrity, you know, those sort of basics of human values or family values.
Well, you know, again, in an ideal world, families are communicating those kinds of things to each other. But as other callers have, you know, brought up, you can have all the conversations in the world. You can give all the guidance that you want to give to children. In the end, they make their own decisions, and they have take the consequences that go along with them. And I think, as I said, I mean, the stories of individual people are very powerful. I'd like to think, as a parent, that I could have some influence on what my child does and the choices that she makes. And I'd like to be there in a moment of need. And I'd like to know that she's, let her know that she's not alone. And, you know, to me, that's part of the whole family value thing.
And Jessica, we're almost out of time here, but Colleen wanted to know about, I guess, the safety issue, whether this pill is, as you know, as I guess, how it compares to a condom, for instance.
Right. Well, in terms of the side effects, the studies have shown that there are no serious long-lasting side effects. That's studies that have been presented to and evaluated by the FDA, as well as studies that have occurred abroad in countries where Plan B has been available for quite a long time. Plus, emergency contraception has also been available in our country by prescription for quite a long time. So this drug has been evaluated very carefully, and as far as we know, there are no serious side effects. Or long-lasting side effects. So it's not a concern in terms of developing bodies.
Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Time. Jessica Ahrens, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Joan Vinaki, thank you very much as well.
Nice to be invited. Thanks.
And you're welcome. Joan Vinaki, columnist for the Boston Globe's op-ed page. Jessica Ahrens, director of the Women's Health and Rights Program at the Center for American Progress. Well, we have to say goodbye and thank you to Heather Bromfield, our super talented intern this year, who tackled all the projects we gave her with intelligence, with resourcefulness and determination. She was a true pleasure to work with, an enormous help to us here at Radio Time. She now graduates from Penn and she's off to explore the world. Have fun, Heather. You deserve it. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Emily Bryant helping us out today. The program produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.